Hello and welcome to the Vorthos cast for what feels like the 50th time in a week. I'm Lorelei Weissel-Labrizzi.
And I'm Chris Delano. And yeah, last week we released three different episodes of the Vorthos cast. So we've been talking to each other a lot this week because, you know, we record the week before it's released. So this is like our third time recording an episode in a week.
I'm tired. Yeah. I'm tired of this. But I need the my brain's not even working for whatever the joke is half formed in my head. So we're going to continue. News. By the time this episode is out, you should be vibrating in your seats in anticipation of the Big Score epilogue stories, which are being published. I don't know if they're both on the same day, but they both should be the beginning of this week. To cap off the Thunder Junction story and kind of reflect on this past year of storytelling. And I'm going to stop myself from talking anymore about them.
We are also, because of the weird timey-wimey shenanigans, our preview came out last Friday as of day of release of this episode, but we are recording it the day before our preview comes out, our preview episode, and so we can't talk about it on this episode. But imagine you are listening to this episode on Monday, the April the 1st. Oh, Lord, this is an April Fool's Day episode, isn't it? Well, this isn't a joke. If you listen to this episode on Monday, April 1st, imagine all of the really cool things we would say about our preview episode, but we can't. So go listen to it. Also, listen to our episode we released middle of last week with Isaac Fellman, the interview about his story No Tells. It's really good, and the interview was incredible, and Isaac is a delight, and you should go listen to it.
Well, now I feel really bad as someone who professes to be sort of funny that we didn't plan anything for April Fools. We have historically done April Fools we have historically done April Fools jokes, and it's even our release day, and we're not doing anything. That's kind of a bummer.
Maybe we'll think of something. Maybe we've made an April Fools joke by the time people are listening to this episode, and they won't even know it. Who knows?
That would make them fools who didn't know a joke was coming.
We don't know a joke is coming yet. We are already the fools.
Yep, we already know we're fools. so we're talking more Thunder Junction story today. We're going to talk about episodes 3 and 4 and one of the side stories that's kind of attached to episode 4.
If you haven't read the stories yet, they are all out and available. We've got like another week of Thunder Junction stories we're going to be telling, and then the big stories are coming out real soon, so we're also going to record about those pretty quickly. So lots of story recaps and discussions happening for the next few weeks.
Yeah, and I guess we're in Flavor Gems.
Oh, yeah, we have to put those on the...
This is a good set for Flavor Gems. Anyway, we're going to start with episode 3, A Train to Prosperity. So we started this episode off back in Eccles' perspective, the leader of the Hellspurs. So we briefly saw him at the beginning of the story looking for something in a carriage that was carrying an object that had just come through the Omen Path. Didn't find it. Seemed pretty angry about it. So he's interrogating someone at the mine, the mine operator, and learns that Oko, this fey shapeshifter criminal, just robbed Bertram Greywater. And maybe this has something to do with what Akul is looking for, because he has many of the keys in this set, but he doesn't have them all. And it turns out our gang is trying to get the last one. And so he ends up doing the evil outlaw thing and being like, I'm gonna threaten you until you tell me information, and I'll make you think that you'll get to go free if you give me the information, and then you do, and then I kill you anyway. Ha ha ha, evil. Because that's Ackle. Meanwhile, the much nicer crowd of people, Oko and his gang, are and Kellen, I guess, who actually is a good boy. Kellen is finally, like, actually meeting the rest of the group after running into his father randomly. So they're all chilling in a saloon, and he sees Ariette and Ashiok, the villains of his first set last year, Eldraine, and he's not very happy about it. And Oko has to do a, like, hey, we're all on the same side here. Whatever your past is, leave that at the door. We have a job to do. Be professional. And remember, this is a kid who fought a mole god in the middle of his office. That's his idea of what professional is.
It's business casual, really.
So we get, like, a lot of fun little character interactions. One of the threads through this story, this series of stories that I really like, is Breaches and Tiny Bones aggravating the hell out of each other, which happens here as well. Karavek, who is an incredibly powerful mage, investigates the key that they stole, and he's like, well, this is really old. It's not any kind of magic I recognize. This is older than Phyrexia or the Thran. I really have no idea what this is. So we should be really cautious. You don't want to unleash another Phyrexia on the multiverse. And everyone's just like, it's probably fine. It's probably not a big deal.
Yeah, there couldn't possibly be anything in the vault that is both creepy and terrifying.
Yeah. And so they know where the vault is. It's in the outlaw city of Tarnation, where the Hellspurs are headquartered. Hellquartered. Yeah, close enough. The problem is, nobody really knows how to get to Tarnation. Ackle has kept the location of Tarnation hidden. And so, unless you're part of his gang, you don't know how to get there. Annie, who's... connections run pretty deep because she's been on Thunder Junction since people started arriving here, is like, hey, there's an outcaster I know named Nolan who might know where this is. The outcasters are kind of one of the big factions in the set. They are the kind of wilderness wanderers and survivalists. So someone like that could have explored and made a map and knows where things are. And so their problem is that Nolan has already been captured by the Sterling Company, which is who they robbed to get the key, and is on a train headed to Prosperity. So we're gonna rob a train, and it's gonna go great.
Time for a train heist, fighting on a train. It's always fun.
We are in, like, classic, the most classic Western trope space right now. And so the gang all gets together. They have this plan to infiltrate this train. Ashiok has set up a telepathic link between them so they can all communicate and coordinate without having to speak with their outside voices.
Remember that detail.
That's an important detail to file away for later. And so Oko, Kellen, and Umezawa are going to steal Nolan. Meanwhile, Reaches is going to blow up a bridge to stop the train. And Gisa and Geralf are going to control some zombies and attack the train to divert guards. And none of this goes according to plan. Gisa, who is really, really excited that she gets to raise a zombie horde, does so way too early. And it causes breaches to explode. The bridge at the wrong time. And Gisa's zombies are tearing through the train, killing people, including the conductors. And the bridge is out, and the train won't stop. And Umezawa gets hurt, and all of a sudden they have to improvise an entire new plan where and use a lot of force, but they do end up getting Nolan onto a horse.
I think it's
Annie. Well, no, it's Fortune. Fortune's not a horse.
Fortune is like a weird.
Fortune is looks, a beast. This is Fortune what the beast creature type is for things yeah. that look kind of weird, but are you point and say, "Yep, that's an animal." We give beast creature type to things like that. Annie and Nolan and the injured Umezawa ride away from the train, and then Oko and Kellen are getting ready to ditch the train because there's no stopping it, and it's gonna crash off this broken bridge. And Kellen is like, wait, but there's all these innocent people on this train. We have to stop the train. And Oko is like, no, we don't. We have what we came for. And Kellen's like, but the people. And Oko says, sucks to suck, skill issue. And jumps off the train. Kellen, who's a big-time hero, he feels really uneasy about his father in this moment. And is like, hey, is it just me? Or does my dad kind of suck? And decides to be a big hero instead. So he uses his fey magic, his, like, bramble whips to... Spider-Man to the train and pull as hard as he can to magically try and stop it. And while he's only able to like hold it back, he can't actually stop the train's forward momentum. And so he holds the train back enough so that everyone on the train can escape. And then as soon as, you know, everyone is safe and sound and away from the tracks, he kind of releases the train and it goes plummeting into this canyon. Because you need a good train explosion at the end of your train heist, because it's cool.
Worth mentioning that Annie helps him at the end, helps him
yeah.
get people off the train, because Annie, also a good person.
Sort of, kind of. Yeah. She is an outlaw. She does have a seedy backstory.
Yeah. Oko abandons his son and Annie comes and helps him. So that's going to be relevant for the next story. But just like imagine starting a group chat with Gisa and Breaches in it. Like who thought that was going to go well? Who was like, I'm going to telepathically connect Gisa and Garof for one thing, and then also throw in the Chaos Goblin into the mix. Well, the other Chaos Goblin, not Gisa, but like actual Goblin. That was a recipe for disaster from the beginning.
Yeah. This is where Annie really earns her I'm not a stepdad, I'm just the dad who stepped up shirt.
Kellen has so many step-parents. He's got a step-dad, good for him. Now a step-aunt. Annie is big aunt energy. Like, her nephew is like a central part of her story, and it's just like, yeah, you're an aunt. She gives off big... favorite aunt energy, who shows up to the Christmas party with her roommate, brings the best presents, goes outside to smoke and never comes back into the party. Like, just love Annie Flash.
They were roommates.
Yeah. But no, I like this story. I like a train heist. Train heists are fun.
Especially, you know, when they don't go correctly. Like, if you're gonna do a heist, and this story does many heists, we are always heisting here. Your heists can't ever go all according to plan. That's no fun. And this one goes really bad. but I think, like, This is the story of all the ones in the set that I think best exemplifies the difference between how Oko and Kellen think, and like the massive rift between them. That Kellen now is staring down into and realizing that, oh no, I had all these ideas about my father being heroic and how I could live up to that. And it turns out he sucks. Yikes.
I don't know if Kellen thought his dad would be heroic, but I think he thought his dad would be more like him.
He wanted his dad to be heroic.
Yeah. I think he assumed that his dad would have some of the same like morals and scruples that Kellen has for himself. And then was like, oh, turns out just because someone is your father doesn't mean that they're actually like anything like you. Sometimes they just provided part of your DNA, and now they're like 40 years old. They don't have a house or a job, and they're robbing a train. Like, Oko is just kind of a deadbeat. I guess he's got a house. He's got a saloon. All right, I'll give him that. He's got a place to live, but he's got a lot of roommates.
It happens. And they were roommates. You want to talk about the next story before I say, and they were roommates again?
Well, there is a, and they were roommates moment in one of the stories, but yeah. So, they have successfully kidnapped / rescued / stolen Nolan. It's kind of hard to tell what's going on here because Nolan wasn't exactly with the Sterling Company by his own volition, but he also like didn't really have a choice in whether or not he was going to get taken by Oko. Start of the story has Ashiok working some mind sculpting on Nolan. Don't worry about it. Just remember this later, and get some memory extractions and finds out that there is a map to Tarnation. Nolan knows all about this map, and that map is buried in what is a massive graveyard called Thief's Folly. Just A+ name for a graveyard, by the way. Like that is a perfect name for like a Western genre graveyard, Thief's Folly. So Annie and Kellen at this moment are like having a little bit of a heart to heart talk because Kellen is like, hey, don't hurt this guy. Like, he's, you know, got nothing to do with this. He's innocent. We're basically using him. And, you know, Ashiok, for their, you know, credit, was like, no, I'm not going to hurt them. But Kellen is like, you know, we have to make sure this guy gets somewhere where he can live. And Annie supports him, and they go off to escort Nolan to, you know, a place where he can like actually get some water and be safe and have a little heart to talk.
I think they said the nearest oasis. He's an outlier. Yeah. He's an outcaster. He can find his way from there.
Yeah, he'll be fine as long as he's not literally dropped in the middle of the desert with no water. He's got to be somewhere close to a oasis. But they have a little heart to heart about family and trusting people. It's a great little moment. Annie is a wonderful step aunt. But they come back and the crew, the whole little criminal organization, comes to a conclusion. They need the map from Thief's Folly, and it's a massive graveyard. So what are they going to do? They're going to send Gisa and Garof to go get it. And that's where we are going to take a moment and pause on episode 4, Finding Tarnation, because there's a side story that happens in the middle of this story. And that is the side story, A Pleasant Family Outing by Seanan McGuire, who... A+, incredible, love the choice to have her come back to write a Gisa and Garof story, because this is the story of the adventure of Gisa and Garof to Thief's Folly. Essentially, there's, like with any Gisa and Garof story, there is a frame to this one. It couldn't be letters being sent back and forth because these two characters are like with each other the entire time. So instead, the framing is that Garof is writing a monogram, which... for those of you unfamiliar, a monogram is like a shorter book on like a very specific topic. So like you might write a monogram about a particular time in a historical person's life or on like a very specific subject. In this case, Garof is writing a he's writing it on his theories about essentially mana bonds. Like, we're getting a reference to tapping lands for mana in a story in 2024, for all of you old school fans out there. But essentially, Garof is theorizing that a person of magical inclination pulls their power from their home plane and that when they leave their home plane, if they're gone for an extended period of time, they will lose that connection to that magic and they will lose their ability to use it. Or they'll take on the magic from the plane they go to and it will change essentially the composition of their power. He's just got this theory, and that's why he's really here, is to sort of like research it. And he makes his sister into his research subject. He's going to be watching her and her innate ghoul calling powers, because the magic of Innistrad is very different in terms of necromancy than other planes. So he's keeping an eye on that. But one of the first things that happens is they have to get their horses. I don't want to say neither of them ride a horse, but they're getting their mounts for their trip. And Gisa, of course, just summons like a dead chimera of some kind. She like raises this little amalgamation of animal parts from the soft grave earth around a stable. And Geralt just goes and steals a jackrabbit. A jackalope.
Very different creature.
Yes. It's just a giant jackalope and he steals it. It's very cute to imagine him on a jackalope. But they make their way to Thief's Folly. While on their way there, they have to like take a little break. They have to stay overnight, and Gisa summons up some undead critters to keep watch while she's sleeping. And Geralt makes the note that necromancy on Innistrad, when you like raise a ghoul on Innistrad, the ghoul just kind of stays around. Like, you don't have to continually keep it up. It just stays up. And that's sort of an innate thing about Innistrad's ghoul callers that's untrue about other necromancers from other planes. Typically, when a necromancer on a different plane raises a zombie, they have to keep it raised through some sort of magical means, or else it'll just sort of fall apart. But on Innistrad, they just stay there, which causes a lot of problems, as you can imagine. Read all of the Innistrad stories. But Geralt notices that Gisa's magic doesn't seem to be waning here as much as he thought it would. These little critters are still just staying around, even while she's sleeping. So they make their way to Thief's Folly. On their way into this massive graveyard, essentially, they do see that there is another horse like parked outside, but they don't really see anyone with it, so they just kind of ignore it for now. But it is a reference that you'll need to remember later. But they go into the graveyard and they're looking around trying to figure out where this map would be. And Geralt starts reading all the tombstones because he's like, how are there so many dead bodies? How is there a giant graveyard on a plane that was like uninhabited a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, whatever? Which is a good question you as a reader were probably also asking. Why does this plane that is like sparsely populated and was totally uninhabited for a very long time suddenly just have a huge mausoleum and graveyard? Turns out a lot of these bodies came from off plane. Geralt discovers that like, hey, a lot of these people were dead before they got here. Gisa also notices that. She's like, some of them are really unhappy that they're here. And then Geralt is reading tombstones and realizes that like there are like some glyphs carved into them. And after a moment, he makes the realization that there's a trap that has been laid here. There's something preventing necromancy on this graveyard, or at least a trap for it. But he realizes it just a moment too late, because Gisa has been, you know, singing her little ghoul caller song, and she goes to raise a ghoul, but her song gets trapped in it. And suddenly a whole bunch of ghouls start raising, and they form into what is a giant corpsipede, as it is described in the story, because if it's a Shannon McGuire story with the Kasani, how do you pronounce their last name?
Yeah.
Well, if it's Shannon McGuire story with Gisa and Geralt, there's going to be a giant undead monster for them to contend with. And in this case, it is a corpsipede that starts just sort of destroying the graveyard as it keeps collecting all these bodies, because it has essentially sucked up Gisa's song. And so more and more undead are being raised. The twins, of course, run out of the graveyard and they run into that person who had the horse stabled outside, Stella. She is a member of the Atene. She is also a slick shot, is I believe what they're called.
Mm-hmm.
And she was here to visit an ex-roommate's grave. I think the story is pretty explicit that she was here visiting someone who she used to, you know, be involved with. But she's there to visit the grave, and you're not supposed to disturb a person's grave. And so she wants to stop this corpsipede as much as the twins do. And so turns out she just happens to be also doing some light interplanar smuggling and has with her some angel blood. You might be asking, why would someone just be carrying angel blood? Why wouldn't you? If you had access to it, wouldn't you also want to have some angel blood on hand?
Sometimes you get thirsty.
In case you get thirsty. But she's got an angel blood and she's got some lamp oil, and good news, that's all Garolf needs to do some necromancy of his own. So he runs off with his lamp oil and his angel blood and comes back with a horrible monstrosity of Gisa's little chimera mount with wings and all sorts of things stitched to it. While he's doing this, Gisa and Stella like have a beer together and just sort of like chat. It's very fun. It's very cute. Shannon really knows how to write these characters. But the little flying scab that Garolf made manages to distract the corpsipede long enough for Gisa to follow the magic and find a cursed heart that was from Innistrad that someone brought here to lay the trap with. And they destroy the heart, which causes the corpsipede to fall apart. Gisa brings back her magic. She calls back her song, and they find the map. It was just right there, perfectly placed to be protected by this cursed heart. Garolf leaves his little creation at the graveyard to act as a new guardian of the graveyard, because, you know, you don't want a bunch of grave robbers disturbing the dead. And they ride off into the sunset to return to the main story. And that's the end of our interlude. We can go back to episode 4 now.
Yeah, which, you don't want grave robbers disturbing your dead. That's for necromancers to do.
Honestly, yes. I think that is true. It's
just job security.
It's just job security. But it is very funny because they say in the story, it's like, we're going to send Gisa and Garolf over to this this graveyard. And then there's like a paragraph break. And then it's like, all right, Gisa and Garolf are back, and they are tired and beat up and scuffed up, and they've got blood on them, bruised and stuff like that. It's like, well, what happened? Well, that side story is what happened. But they come back with the map and they're like, we found it. Here's how you get to Tarnation. And Oko's like, all right, well, now we know how to get there. Here's the thing. If we go in as like a big crew, we're just going to get killed. So we're going to dress like Hellspurs. We're going to keep a real low profile. We're going to look like we belong. We're going to try and figure out where Ackle is and where he keeps his key. And Oko's like, all right, we need a team. And Vraska's like, I'm coming. You can't stop me. And then Oko's like, great. Also, we need Annie, because she knows all of the people who've worked with Ackle. So she'll know who we need to find and follow. But we need one more person. Who could it be? Who could be the last person we take? Oh, and then Oka's like, all right, Kellen, you're coming with me. And you may think, like, aren't there other people on the team who would be more appropriate than Kellen? Maybe, but narrative says it has to be Kellen, and also Oko has plans. So the four of them dress up as Hellspurs, and they go into the city, and they go to Tarnation, and they keep everyone else outside of the city kind of in waiting, because the plan is to get the keys and go to the vault. The vault, by the way, is this like enormous rock just like hovering above Tarnation. There's like rock, like lava coming out of it. It's real gross looking. But they go into the city, and on their way in, Kellen sees this like dueling ground right outside where people are fighting each other to the death. And it's really grisly. And he's like, oh, I don't really like these people. That seems like a bad thing to do. They go into a bar. They're trying to keep a real low profile. Kellen goes and sits by himself at a table. And of course, immediately people can just look at him and be like, you are not an evil criminal. You are an innocent little boy, and you are not supposed to be here.
Mm-hmm.
And they get caught. Big fight happens. Really fun bar fight scene where Vraska and Oko and Annie and Kellen are fighting off people. And then turns out one of Ackle's lieutenants, who goes by the name of, forgetting it off the top of my head, I have to find her name, Twist Fandango, which is just an awesome name.
Uh-huh.
But she interrupts them and ends up capturing them. They're thrown into a jail cell with some magical handcuffs, essentially, that, you know, keep them from using their magic, which gets rid of most of Oko's disguise. But he was wearing actual, like, an actual vest with, like, bones and stuff all over it, which is a note for a future story. And it leaves them pretty exposed. And then Akul comes in and is like, oh, hey, you're that guy who robbed Bertram, and you got me the last piece of the key. Thank you. I'm going to kill you all now. But Kellen's like, hey, no killing us. Instead, I challenge you to a duel. And Akul's like, no, you're a child. I am a giant dragon. Not going to happen. But Oko speaks up and is like, what, are you scared of him? You're scared of the little kid? You're such a coward. You're so fearful. You won't fight anyone. And then Akul just agrees. He's like, you know what? Let's do it. We're gonna have a duel at High Moon. It begins at midnight. It's the idea. So Akul and Kellen are set up to duel each other in the next episode. And if Kellen wins, they all get free. But if Akul wins, Kellen dies. And so do the rest of them. So that is the end of episode 4, setting us up for a real big 2-part finale in the next episodes.
I love when a villain's character flaw is too angry for their own good and too proud for their own good. I love when you can goad people into doing stuff in a story. It's always fun.
It's good because it gets set up earlier with, like, Akul's character, like when he's interrogating the overseer of the mine, and he's like so confident that he can get what he wants when he kills the guy. He's like, he doesn't care about anything, but he exudes this sort of sense of, like, I am the strongest, most powerful person. No one can challenge me. And so when he is challenged, he has to, you know, respond to it. He can't just let it go. And I think that is a good characterization that's been set up already.
And in his defense, he's got a point. He is a big dragon.
He is a big dragon and very deadly. I do like when the story came out and people are like, how silly is it to bring Kellen with you? And I'm just like, y'all, of course Oko would bring Kellen. Like, he wants to get caught. Like, it's so obvious in the story that is, like, the intention here. That gets brought up in the next episode, though. No spoilers, but, like, you can't read this and think that this wasn't some plan from Oko. It's pretty on the nose.
Yeah, he wants to get to know his son better, obviously. Because he cares about family.
None of that is true.
That's true. It's true that what I said was not true. no. Yeah. Everything Oko says always comes from an angle. He's an angle shooter. He's shooting angles. As opposed to shooting angels. Because that's more Liliana's thing. My big takeaway from episode 4 is how good of a name Twist Fandango is for an outlaw. Like, it still just sticks in my head. It's so good.
It'd be really cool if there was a card for Twist Fandango, but
I don't remember if she has one or not.
We're going to find out. I mean, preview season's almost over, but it's a real good name for a character. It's a real good name for an outlaw. But yeah, I really love Shannon's side story about the Garof and Gisa. I thought Shannon did an incredible job with it. I mean, like, as you would expect, it's a Garof and Gisa story. It's written by Shannon McGuire. She knows those characters very well at this point. She making the choice to have Garof writing a little, like, monogram. Excuse me, monograph. It's a monograph. Monogram is the thing you, like, stitch into your clothing. But having Garof write this monograph is, I think, really a very, like, fun way to keep up the, like, banter between the siblings that is present in, like, their earliest writings and the letters and things like that. And then also Shannon wrote for the March of the Machine side story, Family Game Night. So it's nice to keep that going. And I thought this was a really clever way of doing it. There's some really fun little insults between them. I think Shannon said, like, one of the first lines she wrote was it's at the very end of the story where Gisa is writing in the margins. She says, blah, blah, I am Garolf Kasani, and I have tiny little mole eyes. I can't even see my paper without my glasses, and my sister is so much better than me. And it's just very funny. I love her.
You know, I would believe that Garolf monograms all his clothing, though.
Oh, he does, for sure.
He just seems like the kind of guy who, like, every pair of underwear he owns has, like, a little GC monogrammed into the tag.
They all have GC monogrammed on them, and then they also have a day of the week. You know, so he's always wearing, he knows when he runs out of clean underwear.
That's so organized of him.
Meanwhile, I don't know if Gisa owns underwear, but that's a different conversation.
I'm so happy that she's in the set, and that there's a card in the set with a flavor text quote from her where she's controlling a zombie horde like a barn dance caller. Barn dance caller was one of my big wants for flavor text in the set, because, like, hey, like, what are flavor text things we can do that we can't do on any other world? And, well, when you're on a world where barn dance would actually be part of the culture and is part of the cultural inspiration of the set, gosh golly, this is where you do it. And so Gisa, who controls zombies with music, is obviously the perfect character to be like, I just have this image of Gisa seeing a barn dance and being like, and looking at the caller and being like, who is this powerful wizard who controls all these people with such lively music? I must do this too. And then adapts barn dance calling to her own musical stylings of zombie control. It's a fun thought. I like those kits. They're disasters. I'm so happy Shannon got to write a side story for them.
There's a lot of disasters in this little group. Kellen, honestly, is one of them. That boy does not pick up on the clues very quickly that his father is a dastardly man who he should not be trusting. Annie picked up on those clues immediately. Annie was just like, immediately like, hey, buddy, you should think about trusting your dad. You should put some thought into this.
I like all these dorks.
I like them, too. It's a good little crew. I'm glad that we got these people. Most of them, all of the people in this crew fit really well together. So shout out to Akemi for, we should also mention, yeah, all these, the main stories are written by Akemi Dawn Bowman. We talked about that last week a little bit. She did a really good job of bringing these characters together and having them really mesh in a way that feels right, you know?
Yeah, the thing that is hardest to do in a story like this, that I think is one of the strongest things about her writing in these main set stories, is the character-to-character interactions. I think the way characters, she writes about characters feeling about each other and messing with each other and sometimes supporting each other, I think is anytime she talks about two characters off together doing something, like, those are the highlight moments for me for the story. I think she nailed all of them.
There's a really fun moment at the start of episode 4 where Umezawa is getting stitched up by Garolf, and, like, Gisa is, like, hovering over, being like, ooh, is this gonna be a new toy for me? She offers to Umezawa, I can take all your pain away. And it's very, very cute, because Umezawa's like, if I pass out, don't let your sister anywhere near me, you know? Because, like, if you think about it, like, this is... The thing about Thunder Junction that has the potential for being, like, the coolest thing about the setting is that this is a crime boss from Kamigawa being operated on by a Stitcher from Innistrad. Like, this interaction is very... There's just a lot of room for it to be funny. There's, like, a lot of room for it to be fun, interesting. There's a lot of space for that. And I like it when Thunder Junction does that. giving us this like, oh, these are two characters who would never interact, but have a really interesting relationship to each other because of who they are. You know, like Kamigawa has its back, you know, alley surgeons and like people who will clean up criminal wounds. Innistrad has that too. It's just those surgeons might also turn you into a giant walking chimera of body parts.
It's fine.
It's fine. But it's fun.
Yeah. One of the big things when I was working on the set for creative text that I kept in mind was that this is a very multi-culti world. This is a melting pot of the multiverse. These are all immigrant cities where with massive amounts of cultural exchange, people are like learning about other planes for the first time. There are a lot of fun moments where we get to see all these culture clashes in fun ways. You know, the way people from one plane will interact with people from another plane. Like, there's a card preview that has a Trojan horse on it because people from Theros are using the Trojan horse technology to smuggle on this world. Because it's like, hey, this very famous thing happened on Theros that fooled a bunch of people. What if on Thunder Junction, when we know that nobody else in this world has heard of this, which means they're all fools that we can fool again using the same trick. We can just run back our greatest hits of deception. And I think that's really fun and goofy. And like, Thunder Junction has a lot of its own identity as a world, but it also has DNA from every plane in Magic. And so, like, while we got to see a lot of different planes in March of the Machine, they were all isolated. We get to see a lot of different planar things here, but they're all mixing and merging and interacting and affecting each other and changing each other and being mixed into new ways. And that's one of my favorite things about this set.
Yeah. I think that is, and we'll have more to say about Thunder Junction when we get done with all the story, but one of the things I think is the highlight of the setting is the way that things can interact finally.
It's definitely something I want to talk about more when we do flavor gems, because there's some good flavor text that talks about stuff like this.
There's also,
but that's for later.
Yeah. To be fair, I do have criticisms of it, but also I think there are times where it really works. The Trojan horse, like you mentioned, is, I think, one of the like funniest things for me of like, oh, yeah, this is just something straight up from Theros, just on the plane. And then like Gisa and Geralf being here, too, just like turns out there's a lot of opportunities for a fun necromancer situation. So. But yeah, I like the stories we've got coming up next week. We are going to be covering the big finale of the whole story. So you should read it if you have not read it yet, because the last episode sure does have quite an ending to it. We're going to talk about that. But remember some of the things we talked about today when you read episode 6, because it's relevant. Yeah. Otherwise, looking like kind of a shorter episode, because it's just the two of us to talk about it, and we talked about everything that happened.
I'm done.
Yeah, we've recorded a lot of podcasts. There's a lot of podcasts this past week, so go listen to them.
Patreon.com/TheVorthosCast. Give us money, please.
Yes, and also share our episodes with people. Like, listen to them, and also tell other people to listen to them. Review our show on various review sites. I think iTunes, yes. You can. We've never really like asked people to do that, but it is a thing that I'm like, I would like to know if people like our show, and I would like people to find our show who aren't aware of it. So the best way to do that is to share it with your friends and review it and talk about it. So we can get people listening to us talk about Magic Story.
Even if it's just our interview episodes, because that's our good, cool, unique content.
Yeah.
And they're really fun to do. And I love how much background we get to talk about with authors. Go listen to our interview episodes and tell people about them and share them with your friends and your enemies and your crushes and your parents. And rent a plane and drop leaflets advertising our podcast across the countryside.
Definitely, please go listen to our interview with Isaac Fellman. It's really, really good. It's a really, really good episode. If you are at all interested in like outsider perspectives of writing magic or interested in trans authors writing trans characters, like it's a good one. It's a real good one.
I have no final thoughts.
I really don't either.
My final thought is I'm tired. You can probably hear it in my voice. I am tired. I took a big nap today right before this. So I'm like groggy, half awake, recording podcast voice. Anyway, Thunder Junction, exciting. Patreon, thank you folks for supporting us there. Everyone out there who listens to our show, thank you for listening. This has been the Vorthos Cast.